Good afternoon, everyone. Welcome to the first of this year's University Colloquium series. I'm very pleased to introduce today's speaker, who's one of our own, Professor Peter Dula from the Bible and Religion Department. Peter, I'm going to try to remember all this, but I do have your CV in my pocket here if I need a cheat sheet. But Peter was an EMU grad from 1992, did his master's work at Associated Mennonite Biblical Seminaries, and then completed his doctorate at Duke University in 2004. He started here as a faculty member in 2006. If I had to describe Peter in two words, I think I would use the words boundary crosser. Between his getting his education done and starting here as a faculty member, he crossed a number of international boundaries. He taught at Masoreti Christos College in Ethiopia. He did work with Mennonite Central Committee in Burundi and Iraq. His intellectual work also crosses boundaries in interesting ways, and I think we'll hear some of that today. His dissertation is on a philosopher who has something to say about theology. So his work really spans the boundaries between philosophy and theology. He's also a co-editor of a book that, if I recall correctly, is actually called Crossing Boundaries, right? Something like that. On interfaith issues. So he's done a lot of important work on how we span the boundaries between different religious faiths. The talk today is called Scenes of Instruction, and I think he's going to be talking to us a bit about the philosopher he's studied, Stanley Cavell. And I know I'm looking forward to it. The talk today is based on work he did on his sabbatical last year, so we all had a part in supporting that work as well, and so I'm very eager to hear the outcome and the conversation afterwards. So welcome, Peter.
Thank you very much, Fred. Thank you to I thank the Faculty Status Committee that granted me this sabbatical. So Fred and I guess Nancy was dean then, so thank you very much. Thanks to the rest of you for coming out. Presented a number of papers at conferences over the course of my sabbatical, and was trying to think of which one would be most appropriate for this audience. And I did one at a conference on Anabaptist identity on the poetry of Julia Kasdorf, and I thought, well, that would be appropriate. And did one on friendship and conflict in the Gospel of John, and I thought that would be appropriate. And I also did one for a workshop at Princeton Center for Theological Inquiry on Stanley Cavell, and I thought, well, that's not going to be appropriate because no one there knows any about him. So I picked that one. Just to introduce you a little bit to the work I do, I wrote a book on Cavell, and his memoir came out after my book, and I wanted to think about his memoir in light of some of the stuff I did in my book. So let me just add that the workshop was called Confessional Improvisation, Wittgenstein and Cavell After Augustine, and the text for that workshop were Augustine's Confessions, Wittgenstein's Philosophical Investigations, and Cavell's memoir, Little Did I Know. The challenge then with presenting that text here is that I didn't present it at the workshop. Everyone had it beforehand, they read it, we discussed it. So I never had to knock it down into 40 minutes. The other challenge is everyone at that workshop had read the same text, so I didn't need to provide any background. So what I've tried to do in the last few days is both lengthen it by giving you the background and shorten it to make it 45 minutes long. We'll see what happens. Okay. In 2010, Stanley Cavell published Little Did I Know, a massive and stunning work of over 550 pages. Because it aspires to be both a work of philosophy and a work of autobiography, it is unlike almost anything out there. It is easier to describe this memoir's story to you than to account for its philosophical ambition. Cavell is born in 1926 to Eastern European Jewish immigrants on the south side of Atlanta. His mother is a fantastically gifted musician, and it is circumstances, not lack of talent, that keep her from moving to New York to become the pianist for Radio City Music Hall Orchestra. His father is a brutish man, prone to unaccountable rages, drifting from various jobs at liquor stores and pawn shops. The first 7 years of Cavell's life are idyllic ones, surrounded by aunts, uncles, and cousins on his mother's side. The next 10 are ones of heartbreaking isolation, which she describes as alone with his friendlessness. The only relief from which comes because his talent at piano, clarinet, and saxophone enables him to find a place as the only white guy in a successful jazz band when he is just a teenager. At 16, he goes to Berkeley as a music major, from there to Juilliard, where he discovers that the life of music is not for him, quits going to classes, starts spending his afternoons at the movies and his evenings reading Freud, Nietzsche, Pascal, Kierkegaard. He ends up back in college in California, this time in LA as a philosophy major, moves on to graduate school at Harvard, appointment to its Society of Fellows, on to one of Harvard's endowed chairs, and a career as one of the most category-defying and misunderstood philosophers of his time. That's the story in a paragraph. On the screen behind me is the last page of the memoir. Cavell's father has just had a pacemaker placed in his heart. His mother is exhausted and worried, and so Cavell takes an early morning flight from Boston to Atlanta to see his father. His father is sleeping when he arrives, and when he awakes, they have this conversation. I'll give you just a second to glance at it. Okay, that's enough. I don't have very much time. I will come back to it. I've been baffled by this ending ever since the first time the book came out. And I read it like a 12-year-old with the latest Harry Potter, or like a 35-year-old, for that matter, with the latest Harry Potter. It may seem like an anticlimactic ending, or at least a curious one. Why Cavell chose this scene to end 500 pages of reflection is my topic for this afternoon. Whether that seems like a suitably interesting and ambitious topic for weeks of sabbatical work is a question I hope you're willing to wait approximately 40 minutes to answer. I've chosen to understand this text and this question itself as a scene of instruction. The term scene of instruction is Cavell's, but he doesn't use it for this passage. He uses it for two moments in Wittgenstein's Philosophical Investigations. Starting there might help provide an approach to this text. What you have before you is a paragraph from Augustine's Confessions. It is the paragraph that opens Wittgenstein's Investigations. When they, my elders, named some object and accordantly moved towards something, I saw this and I grasped that the thing was called by the sound they uttered when they meant to point it out. Their intention was shown by their bodily movements, as it were, the natural language of all peoples, the expression of the face, the play of the eyes, the movement of other parts of the body, and the tone of voice, which expresses our state of mind in seeking, having, rejecting, or avoiding something. Thus, as I heard words repeatedly used in their proper places in various sentences, I gradually learned to understand what objects they signified. And after I had trained my mouth to form these signs, I used them to express my own desires. Wittgenstein famously opens the Investigations with this obscure passage from the Confessions. Wittgenstein's text, concerned primarily with philosophy of language, is then taken to be a long critique of the particular view of self and language enshrined in these lines of Augustine's. Augustine mistakenly generalizes from a specific kind of word names to all language. He conceives of meaning as deriving from a correspondence between words and objects. he neglects how much else goes into language learning aside from definitions. And finally, the passage is based on a mind-body dualism. These are all serious philosophical issues, and Wittgenstein's investigations, alongside a handful of other texts, provide our best account of them. So most readers, accounting for the appearance of Augustine in this text, take it as an example, perhaps an inaugural example, of everything that is wrong with Western philosophy until the arrival of postmodernism. Cavell doesn't disagree that there are significant issues with Augustine's short description of his childhood language acquisition. But precisely for that reason, it's all the more interesting that Cavell reads Wittgenstein's choice of this opening much differently, more expansively than any other Wittgenstein scholar. He wants to know, why does Wittgenstein start with this? He could have chosen any random description of language learning from a vast range of classic texts. Why pick this one? Cavell notes a number of reasons. I'll mention just two. First, Wittgenstein chooses to begin with a child. More precisely, with the memory of childhood. Most striking to Cavell is how lonely this child is. Glance back at the passage. See how isolated the infant seems. See what a model student he is. Perceptive, curious, independent, full of desire to learn. But see what terrible teachers his elders are. He is not observing their interactions with him so much as their interactions with each other. A few pages later in the Confessions, there's a lovely passage of the infant interacting with his nurses, which more nearly captures the play of baby and caregiver. But that is absent here. Cavell says the scene portrays language as an inheritance, but also as one that has, as it were, to be stolen. Any way in which the capacity and perhaps the motivation to take it is altogether greater than the capacity and motivation to give it. In that light, the next several hundred pages are not just about correcting Augustine's intellectual mistakes, but about educating ourselves on how to be better parents and teachers, such that our lives with our children and students do not leave them as lonely as this image. Second, Wittgenstein chooses to begin not just with any kind of text, but with a confession. The Investigations is unlike anything in philosophy stylistically. It just doesn't sound like anyone before or since. And according to Cavell, one way to account for this is to suggest that Wittgenstein has abandoned the usual genres of philosophy and theology, dogmatics and dialogue, in favor of a confession. The thought experiments it contains are voices of temptation and resistance, of doubt and repentance. And all those voices are Wittgenstein's, not just the philosophically correct ones. And so this text, unlike others, is not so much to be believed, but tested against one's own experience, against one's own confession, and then accepted or rejected. That's scene of instruction two. 217 sections later in the Investigations, we find another scene of instruction. How am I able to obey a rule? If this is not a question about causes, then it's about the justification for my following the rule in the way I do. If I have exhausted the justifications, I have reached bedrock and my spade is turned, then I am inclined to say, this is simply what I do. This passage was made much of by Saul Kripke in his little book, Wittgenstein on Rules and Private Language. Kripke is one of the most influential American philosophers. He teaches at Princeton. He recently won the Schock Prize, which is given by the Royal Swedish Academy, the people that do the Nobel. It's like the Nobel for philosophy, except it's only given every 3 years because there's not enough philosophers out there to give an award every year. His reading of Wittgenstein was influential and original enough that his book is often referred to as Kripkenstein. Cavell didn't like Kripkenstein very much. Without getting into details, I want to briefly say why. Cavell thinks Kripke's reading slightly alters the last two sentences to, "If I have exhausted the justifications, I have reached bedrock, and my spade is turned, then I am licensed to say, this is simply what I am inclined to do." Both Kripke and Cavell explicitly envision this as a scene between a teacher and a child. Bedrock, for both, is the moment when the teacher or parent runs out of reasons and argument and finds him or herself exhausted by the why questions. At some point, you just have to say, this is what we do. Many of us in this room have children or nieces or nephews or students. And though paragraph 217 is part of a specific discussion of rules for following a series, we know what he means. But just as in the previous scene of instruction, Augustine and his elders, it is also not hard, at least if you're Stanley Cavell, to detect a disturbingly dark undercurrent here. Both in different ways are cases of the child's isolation. At some point, difference must be silenced, argument must end, and the responsibility for ending that conversation displaced from the teacher onto some bedrock. Cavell calls it, quote, an air of power or violence, end of quote, and finds it intensified and underlined in Kripke's account. In other words, Cavell hears in Kripke the response to Bruce Hornby's much more famous scene of instruction, "That's just the way it is." According to Cavell, this amounts to denying the note of hesitation or questioning implied by the inclined. And it is precisely that hesitation which Cavell wants to get us to pause with. What I am inclined to say is precisely not something I necessarily go on to say. To say I am inclined is a confession and a hesitation that, with patience, creates a space both for self-questioning, why am I so inclined? Am I the bedrock? And for the discovery of the other before me, to learn from them what they may be inclined to do. If I am inclined to say something further means that if I do indeed say it, I may wish to take it back, may discover precisely in the voicing that it was wrong, might not discover it was wrong without the voicing. Sections 1 and 217 of the investigations are images that Cavell returns to repeatedly, almost obsessively, from his earliest writing to his last. He finds in them, quote, images of children as beneficiaries and victims of the unclear world we have to leave to them. The rest of the investigations is then a record of our discovering the capacity to come specifically, concretely, patiently to their aid in clarifying it, something not perfectly distinguishable from coming to ourselves. In other words, these images of learning language and continuing a series become metaphors for the passing on or inheriting of culture itself. The images of elders and children, teachers and students become for Cavell metaphors for writers and readers. To announce at the beginning of Little Did I Know that this is a philosophical autobiography is to say that this book aspires to the same status. It is also a record of Cavell discovering his capacity to come to our aid in clarifying the world. But while this text aspires to parent and teach us, it's not clear, and it's not supposed to be clear, when it does so in the position of elder writer to child reader, and when it takes up the position of child, beseeching us to to recognize ourselves in what he says, to accept and encourage his attempts to confess, to speak for himself in a way Augustine's elders neglected. So with that background, let's go back or start our way back to the final page. For the long time, I had not noticed that the last three pages of Little Did I Know have a title. In the lengthy, detailed table of contents, they are called To Put Away, Perhaps Not to Discard Childish Things. When I did, well, after my second time through the book, I also realized that the previous section was entitled Howard Hawks, Only Angels Have Wings, Hemingway's To Have and Have Not, and St. Paul's Corinthians 1. I assume that it was an editor who did not want to say 1 Corinthians. Anyhow, Cavell has turned to the love chapter repeatedly in his latest writing in the last 10 years. There are a range of more or less obvious reasons he might do so. I won't mention any of them in the interest of time. But none of what I consider the obvious reasons are paths Cavell takes up at the end of Little Did I Know. Thinking about the title to the novel and the film To Have and Have Not, Cavell writes, I had hitherto always passed by the phrase to have and have not with a momentary qualm that I allowed to fade. But this time I sat still long enough to attract the original sound of the phrase, especially of the slight archness of and have not. Bearing in mind that Hemingway early liked the titles of his novels to refer to fragments of imperishable writing, For Whom the Bell Tolls to John Donne, The Sun Also Rises to Ecclesiastes. The fragment for it to have and have not, come to think of it, steadily enough, is right there in 1 Corinthians 13:2, where St. Paul declares, And though I have the gift of prophecy and understand all mysteries and all knowledge, and though I have all faith so that I can remove mountains and have not charity, I am nothing. A number of things interest me in the way this paragraph introduces 1 Corinthians 13. First, when Cavell writes that he had to sit still long enough to attract the original sound, he is quoting one of his favorite lines from Thoreau's Walden. You only need to sit still long enough in some attractive spot in the woods, and all its inhabitants may exhibit themselves to you by turns. Second, he has alluded to the John Donne devotion from which Hemingway took For Whom the Bell Tolls back on page 19, which we'll return to. Finally, and perhaps most importantly, when Cavell describes passing by the phrase with a momentary qualm, he's describing what Emerson called a rejected thought. Emerson wrote in Self-Reliance, one should learn to detect and watch that gleam of light which flashes across his mind from within, yet he dismisses without notice his own thought because it's his. In every work of genius, we recognize our own rejected thoughts. They come back to us with a certain alienated majesty. Cavell's phrasing both affirms Emerson and extends it, affirms it by explicitly noting 1 Corinthians 13 as a work of genius in which Cavell recognizes his own thought he had previously rejected, as I might say, philosophy has done with theology for hundreds of years. Now, when Cavell brings two of his heroes, Emerson and Thoreau, alongside the biblical writer that fascinates him most, in the closing pages of his memoir, you know something important is going on. But what? Most readers are likely to pass over Paul's nothing as a metaphor for insignificance. But I take it that Cavell is suggesting that Paul's nothing is literal. Cavell chooses to read it as follows, quote, For how can balancing having and not having bear upon human existence, bear so strongly that not having something reveals you as nothing, not to be counted among humankind? counted, my colloquium students in this row know, is a term of art for Cavell. He finds in Paul the declaration that love is an essential criterion of the human, and criteria are the means by which we count something under a concept. Without love, one cannot be counted as human. Once this sinks in, the reading is stunning in its simplicity and originality. Paul, in Cavell's view, is connecting the absence of love with other mind skepticism, with non-existence, connecting it with the central drama of his life's work. But this claim that an absence of love reveals you as nothing, not to be counted among humankind, recalls two other notable moments from the opening section of the memoir, both about Cavell's father. The first is this chilling sentence from the 14th page. "I believe I can date the moment at which I realized my father hated me, or perhaps I can more accurately say, wished I did not exist." A few pages later, he'll describe it as, "My father wanted me dead, or rather wanted me not to exist." The second moment is when, after a fit of helpless rage in his Sacramento pawn shop, his father soils himself. I mean, quite literally, shits his pants. Emerging from his shower and change of clothes, after the teenage Cavell drove him home, he says in Yiddish, "Mensch is gornished. Humankind is nothing." In its own perverse way, that is an inversion of the Pauline claim. And Cavell confesses, "Whatever else I felt for him or wanted from him, I feared and hated my father." The stories of Cavell's father's rage and hatred cast a cold shadow over the entire book. At the same time, they give the book much of its drama. Quote, "It was as if I knew that I would one day find a way out of the devastation he could make of his island. I knew that such a day would never come for him. Don't tell me no man is an island." Not, of course, that I escaped it entirely. Little did I know is the story of Cavell's partial escape, the story of his finding his way out of the devastation, of showing us that he has enough love in him that his father's wish for non-existence has not come true. The brief turn to 1 Corinthians 13 is immediately prior to the scene at his father's hospital bed. But before returning there, it may help to situate it alongside one other scene of instruction in the memoir. This one at his beloved mother's funeral. That maybe we'll just read this. What time is it? Okay. "When the rabbi at my mother's graveside dismissed the company of several dozen people in attendance, Ben," this is Cavell's 5-year-old at the time, "refused to leave as I took his hand. He insisted, 'The coffin is still here.' I replied that since Rabbi Epstein had dismissed us, he must have his reasons. Ben still would not be moved. He and I and the rabbi and 2 workmen standing aside holding shovels were the only ones left by the grave. I glanced at the rabbi, who motioned me to remain. 'The child is right. The service is not over, but we have fallen into the custom of dispersing those in attendance as we lower the coffin and cover it with earth.' This admired and distinguished old man had begun walking around to us on the other side of the open grave and, pulling a shovel from the place it had been stabbed into a neat pile of soil, invited Ben to put his small hands on the shovel's handle between the rabbi's large hands, thus enabled to assist one another in wielding the large implement, they repeatedly, as the coffin was lowered, together sent small clumpy showers of earth down surprisingly softly tapping upon the coffin's lid, in accompaniment to the rabbis completing the chanting of his canonical prayers. In this passage, we are being told as clearly as possible to recall Investigations 2:17. But what interests me is that in Cavell's graveside retelling of Investigations 2:17, he places himself in the role of Kripke. Rabbi Epstein must have his reasons. Is Kripke's resort to rules. It's ending the conversation. The rabbi himself, on the other hand, exemplifies Cavell's argument against Kripke. He allows Ben's unwillingness to leave to become an occasion to go back over ground I had hitherto thought foregone. And the difference in tone and feeling between this scene and his father's hospital bed are striking. Cavell describes himself after his mother's graveside scene as, quote, undisguisedly pent with complicated yet mysterious elation. The softly falling showers of earth and time with the rabbis chanting, the entwinement of Ben's hands with the rabbis make for a stunningly moving image. The feel of this final scene here is much different. While it is by far the longest stretch of dialogue in the book, the language seems to me clunky and awkward, even if the conversation is rather ordinary, awkward in its very ordinariness. Where one is about a request from a son to a father, this is about a request from a father to a son. And where Ben wanted his grandmother to be accompanied all the way to the end, Cavell's father wants to be left alone. It is ugly to act as if the death of an 83-year-old man, as opposed to a child, is an emergency. A reading of it remains far from clear to me, but there seem to be at least two obvious interpretations. I'd be happy for anyone that can provide a third or fourth. The first is that the father is still consumed by self-loathing and wants to die for the wrong reasons, because Mensch is gornished. Then the concern here professed for the lives of children is sheer hypocrisy coming from someone who wished the child Cavell dead. So that's not my job as a way. The only way Cavell can come up with on the spot of saying, I don't want you to die, it answers the question, can I have escaped it? And answers how this scene puts away childish things by showing that Cavell here forgoes the perfect opportunity for a kind of poetic justice. Call it vengeance. Or maybe the father's request is not so much self-loathing as self-pity. He's not looking to die. He's looking for reassurance in his insecurity. Cavell is refusing his childhood role of being a prop for his father's constantly faltering ego. Alternatively, the last page is a reversal of the positions one might expect. This is the father finally demonstrating the dignity that was so rare in his life. Then does Cavell's "That's Not My Job" deny him that dignity? Is it not a philosopher's job to intervene in medical decisions, or not a son's job to get in the way of the best possible care of a father? Isn't the posing of such unanswerable and unending questions just one way a philosopher avoids responsibility? Does it once again sound uncomfortably like Kripke? That's not my job. Like he must have his reasons. His Kripke is just simply what we do. I suppose it's obvious that I want to situate Cavell's relationship with his father in relationship with the two scenes of instruction with which I opened, Augustine and his elders, in Investigations 2:17.
Cavell's reading of Augustine's account of infant language learning as a scene of isolation is one he is prompted to by his own childhood. He identifies with this child and his loneliness, and hence is driven to situate the philosophical issues raised by Augustine's self-portrait within the context of human pain. But it's also a reading he is driven to by the course of his own career. Richard Rorty called Cavell the least defended, the gutsiest, the most vulnerable of American philosophers. His first book was declared to be, quote, deleterious to the future of philosophy. Throughout the memoir, it's clear that Cavell feels acutely the sting of being misunderstood and isolated within academic philosophy. Too many essays too early on Beckett, Shakespeare, film, music, to really count as philosophy. Yet this misunderstood philosopher opens the final scene of his book with an account of his misunderstanding of his father. Do you understand me? You mean, can I hear you? No. What about the second scene of instruction, the quarrel with Kripke? At his mother's funeral, Cavell clearly portrays himself as Kripke. At his father's bedside, I don't think that's exactly the case, but he's leaving himself open, vulnerable to the criticism that he fails to live up to something at the heart of his philosophical achievement. In his discussion of Kripke, he described Kripke's, but that happens a lot, position as a failure to, quote, show readiness, unconditional willingness to continue presenting himself as the representative of the community into which the child is being invited and initiated. The task of representation becomes quite specific at his father's bedside. His father is asking him to represent him to the doctors. In the language that comes to dominate the final section of the memoir, his father is asking him to stand for him. A few pages before the end, there's this. I take Emerson in Self-Reliance to be characterizing human understanding when he says, I stand here for humanity. To stand for something is to represent it. And I do not doubt that Emerson is simultaneously invoking the idea of standing for something, bearing it. Then the implication is that for me to understand humanity is to bear up under the weight of my representation of humanity. But at the same time that Cavell begins pondering the meanings of standing and understanding, he begins to repeatedly describe himself in this book as awkward. To pick just one example, I have, I find, now clothing this writing from memory, been drawn to exemplify, still with some surprise, the condition that telling one's life more completely, say, incorporating awkwardness, becomes one's life, becomes a way of leaving it. I know I keep circling. Do I have to land? I mean, deliver an argument? You understand, of course, that my relationship to these texts is not academic. In a lifetime of reading, no set of texts, no poet or novelist is as dear to me as the work of Stanley Cavell. I do not want him to be Kripke, but I'm not sure what he wants. And if he is the child Augustine, I do not want to be those elders. So permit me one more circle before I touch down, or in any case, stop talking. This memoir takes the form of a diary. It is made up of entries, each usually short, 2 to 5 pages, written almost daily between July 2003 and September 2004. Usually he picks up each day from where he left off the day before, but the form also allows him to jump back and forth in time and to interject news of current events, both in his life and in the wider world. But he opens the book with anticipation of one specific current event in his life. The first line is, the catheterization of my heart will no longer be postponed. My cardiologist announces that he has lost confidence in his understanding of my condition. We must actually look at what is going on inside the heart. This seems at first a transparently obvious metaphor for writing a memoir. But once you see the diary form, you realize that you're waiting each day with him to find out what's wrong with his heart. And you start to think he could die any day. You know the book is 550 pages long. I mean, but it has this effect that it could end on the next day. Late in the book, he claims that the writing of Emerson and Thoreau, quote, seems always to be at or come to an end. These writers bring death into their prose, the acceptance of finitude in each sentence. I understand the diary form of Little Did I Know to be a deliberate instantiation of this. And so there is another scene of instruction here. Equally undertaken in the face of death. The book as a whole is the context in which the other scenes must be placed. So it comes to the question, Cavell writes, what gives us the right to single ourselves out and open our mouths in all seriousness? What gives him the right to single himself out for a memoir? What gives him the right to speak for philosophy? I am inclined to say that such standing can only come from his successes, not his failures. I am inclined to say that such standing could only come from a clear, I don't say dramatic, closing forgiveness scene. And I take it that Cavell ends this book with an example of his awkwardness in order to disabuse me of precisely that notion. He must have his reasons at his mother's graveside, and that's not my job at his father's bedside. Are in their original settings, inclinations. Here in this memoir, however, they are not inclinations, they are confessions. Hence, the interpretive task is not to spin these lines in ways that make them less problematic, but to hear the confession, to understand. Just as we face a choice about how to read That's Not My Job, so Cavell, seeking a way to take his leave, faced a choice about how to end this book. Here at the end, Cavell has placed us in the same relationship to this text as he is to his father in the hospital. Two old men recovering from heart surgery, trying awkwardly to find words with which to bid farewell. I keep neglecting to note that Cavell does in the end go back over his ground and reconsider his refusal to represent his father to the doctors. To, perhaps we can say, put away, if not discard, childish things. And I can't help but think that he knew it would take his readers, at least this one, even longer to go back over their ground and see that he is not trying to prove or even achieve his standing. Standing, like love, is a criterion of the human. No one has any more of it than any other. Let me close with one more quote from the end of the text. Analytical philosophers, the ones who isolated Cavell, do not preoccupy themselves professionally with, for example, my relation to my power of speech, with speech as confrontation, hence with the ineluctable moral fact of assertion, with my declaring my standing in disturbing the world with each of my words. This cannot be a matter merely of style, any more than it is a matter of style that analytical philosophy does not habitually veer toward an interest in theology. Carnap, a founding analytic philosopher, will not have to insist, as Heidegger does, that what he is writing is not theology. But the sense remains in everything I write that philosophy, as I care about it most, is always discovering its lack of authority. One could even say its irreducible resistance to establishing itself. Thank you.
All right, thank you for staying for the whole thing. Anyone who needs to go can go. I think you can ask questions now. Is that right? Lois has a mic and.
Yes.
Yeah.
We have about 10 minutes for questions for Pete. So who would like to be first?
So in your teaching and your parenting, have you found a more relational language to be able, that's maybe not so much based on authority, and able to do that better?
Well, first, I wouldn't say it's not based on authority. I mean, I'd say it's a sort of redescription of authority. I will say with parenting that, I'm not going to say yes, but I will say I'm haunted by these texts constantly. There are occasions when I can match up more or less. With teaching, it becomes it's more an open question for me to think about. What would constitute a class? Well, so Wittgenstein's Investigations, if you would go through that text paragraph by paragraph, allowing the thought experiments to work themselves out, that would constitute it. I've never been patient enough or felt like I could afford to be patient enough to teach like that. It's different also in a seminar than in a lecture room, I think.
So in the two different examples, we have the child who pushes against the routine to say that this ritual doesn't seem complete, to ask something of the elders. And then in the scene with the father, it is the adult who says, this is not my job, and instead seeks out his mother. And I'm just remembering from what we've done in Claim of Reason, that the role of philosophy is sort of the education of the adult. And I wonder, like, what connection you might draw there.
Hang on to the mic. So Jacob is in, so this semester I'm teaching the Honors Colloquium on Stanley Cavell's sort of big book, The Claim of Reason. So, Cavell has a line in there that he says, in the face of the work of Augustine, Luther, Rousseau, Thoreau, all memoirists, yeah, we are all children. We do not know how to go on with them. In that light, philosophy becomes the education of grown-ups. And it's a very enigmatic line, obviously. So Jacob's question is, how does the scene fit into that? So I take it that for Cavell to represent his father would be to grow up, right? To put away childish things, to accept that reversal that comes, I suppose, at a certain stage when he needs to now father his father. And for him to put away childish things here is to do that. Which in the end he does. I was about to say, I'll tell the doctor about our talk. But it's hard for him to do at first.
I've been looking at the last sentence in this text, which is, I walked out to find my mother. And that, to me, just opens up a Pandora's box of questions about this whole project. But it also, in a sense, I think is a reference back to Augustine. Because in the Confessions, the role of his mother is absolutely central to all of the stuff that he does. Perhaps, if you want to go with that idea, Augustine is maybe as shaped by his mother as Cavell is by his mother.
Yeah.
And I don't want to overplay this, but philosophy, as you talk about it, has essentially been a male phenomenon.
Yeah.
I think it's really intriguing that the last line is, I walked out to find my mother, as a hint that maybe there's a hint of something there. You want to comment on that?
Yes. In fact, I've been working on another paper that accounts for, or that tries to account for that last line. Cavell's relationship with his mother is much different. They're very close, very dear to each other. And so obviously she plays a different role in the book, but also it becomes a sort of understated role because the whole drama is this terrible father. So I do think I have a handle on this last sentence, but to explain it would require visiting a whole other text of Cavell's. So we can talk about it sometime. But I also think, when we talked about this in the workshop, you're absolutely right about the parallels between the Confessions and Little Did I Know. Augustine's father doesn't show up very much, but when he does, he's not a very attractive character. And of course, at the end of the, right before Augustine's conversion, he has this vision of continence, the lady continence, who shows up surrounded by children that she's mothering.
Peter, does the rest of the book remove the ambiguity in that last line? Because when you first read it, I thought, I went out to seek my mother. But when Nancy posed her question, I thought he might mean, I went out to discover my mother standing there.
Oh, interesting. This is the last line. So the rest of the book tells us nothing. Interesting. Yeah, that last line had not occurred to me. Or your second reading of it had not occurred to me. So if she's standing outside the door, we're listening to hear what he's going to say. Yeah.
So I'm just wondering if there's something archetypal about this. Maybe we could read it more metaphorically, as a kind of a theological thing between a person and God, maybe. The good Jewish father figure.
Get some sort of Nietzschean death of God thing going. You work on that.
I like your creative way of pulling texts that are not alike, but finding things that connect them. And I'm really intrigued by the 1 Corinthians 13, especially the comment, if I have not love, I am nothing. And the father of Cavell, who says, I am nothing. And in thinking about that, the point is that Paul doesn't say he's nothing. He says, if I have not love. There is a kind of a, it seems like this is a big deal, if you think, at least for me. Did you find something theological in those two statements?
In which two? In the Paul statement and in the... Right. Well, maybe I'll say I found the absence of theology striking. So, one reason that Cavell can turn to 1 Corinthians 13 is because 1 Corinthians 13, does it mention God anywhere?
Right, which obviously is implied, but Cavell can turn to it as a sort of classic text that doesn't commit him to anything. Yeah. Cavell is doing, if you think about the difference between Cavell's confessions and Augustine's, is that Augustine never doubts that God hears everything he says. Right? It doesn't matter that everyone else misunderstands him. I mean, he's like Cavell in that same way. No one gets it. Yeah. But he knows God hears him. And Cavell sort of constantly trying to, where, how do I get the right to speak? Because he doesn't have, he's missing that confidence. Is that the way to say it? I mean, because God is also always undermining Augustine's authority, right? Which is, God doesn't just sort of grant theologians authority. When in that last passage I read, where he says, philosophy I love most is always discovering its lack of authority, he takes that to be a theological claim. I'm not really answering your question, but I will say that there are these scattered enigmatic references to theology throughout the memoir is clearly aware that this would sound different, or there'd be there are missing pieces that if this was a Christian confession, not a secular confession.
Pete, there's been focus on the last sentence. I'm intrigued by the previous two.
Yeah.
I was about to say that I would tell the doctor about our talk, but my father had fallen asleep. It seems to me that he may be pointing to, if isolation is a theme, the first part of that sentence points to the possibility for connection. But then he simply says, my father had fallen asleep. Falling asleep is a fundamental human condition, experience and condition. Is what might be going on there? And then talk about an awkward sentence. The next one, his position appeared awkward to me. I read that literally, initially, that his sleeping position was awkward, but might he be talking about the position of his father in the conversation or his position of his father in life?
Or his position from Cavell's perspective, right? So part of what's awkward about this sentence is his position was awkward, or his position appeared awkward. The two me's suggest this kind of ambiguity. I read that my father had fallen asleep as kind of... there's a sadness there that Cavell doesn't get to say, yeah, I'll do it, right? So he can tell us that he's going to represent his father. He can go back over his ground with us, but he doesn't get to tell his father that. I've fretted over this page for 4 years. Not exactly, but... it really begs a sort of kind of close reading that, yeah. Thanks. Okay, thanks for coming.
Well, thank you, Peter, for a really thought-provoking talk and for reminding me why I so much enjoyed being a philosophy and religion major here at EMC back in the 70s, but... thanks again to everyone for coming. Join us again next month on the third Wednesday. Greta Ann Herron will be talking on a, I expect, very different topic, but also about the research she's been doing over the past year. Looking forward to that as well. So see you back here next month.